This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Welcome to your second workshop, for many of you at least. And Ruben Petersheim is a principal of a school and a nursery. He's a very busy man. He has lived in Baltimore for 10 years, but he grew up as a baby, Amish. I think it's funny how he was born Amish, and now he's a city guy at heart. Ruben is all about the city. If you get him talking about the city, he can talk for hours. So I really enjoyed Ruben, and as he talks about cross-cultural ministry in an urban America, I think we can learn a lot from him, and so I hope that we can receive well what he has to say. Ruben, can you come up so I can pray with you? God, thank you for the gifts that you've given Ruben. Thank you that you have equipped him with many experiences that he's going to share with us. I pray that you open up our hearts to receive what you have to say through him, and just give him strength, God. Pray this in your name. Amen.
Good morning. So just checking, how many of you live in the city? All right. How many of you would like to live in the city? Those of you that aren't already. Good. That's a good thing. So I'm guessing that's why you're here, because you're interested in hearing about how culture works in the city. A couple questions to begin with. Fact or fiction? You haven't had a chance to look at this list. I'm just about to give it to you because I decided not to give it to you ahead of time. So a couple questions, and you can think, you know, where do you land on this? Is this true or is this not true about cities? Small businesses are more likely to survive in the city than in the country. Who's going with fact? Who's going with fiction? All right, so some of these I'm not necessarily going to answer. Yeah, you can actually ask me at the end. I will hopefully get some chance to come back to this. The majority of the people in the city are on welfare. Fact or fiction? Fact? Not many hands. Fiction? A number of hands. And that's actually, there's definitely more people in the city who are on welfare than are in the country, but it's not a majority of the people. And I'll talk more about some of that in a bit. Shopping locally is important to urban people. Fact or fiction? Fact? Fiction? All right, so you're getting there. So that is a fact. Again, I'll come back to some of that. Most families in the city are broken, not two-parent families. Now, this is kind of a trick question, but again, fact or fiction? All right, a few of you are fiction. It really depends on the people that you're working with in the city. And again, that's a big part of what my talk is going to focus on this morning. People in the city dislike farmers. Fact? Fiction? All right. So for the most part, I know that it's often the people in the city who can drive the movements to make laws that make things hard for farmers. But if you actually learn to know the people of the city, many of them are actually very appreciative of the people outside the city who make stuff that we can eat. Urban people are environmentalists. They're those tree huggers that we hear about. Weird. Fact or fiction? Fact? Fiction. Okay, well, again, that's kind of a mixed package as well. I have a story about that I'll tell you later. One of the things that has been helpful for me is, I don't know how many of you have heard of this, but the Perspectives on the World Christian Movement. This is a course that is taught. It's offered often by churches. And my wife and I took this just before we moved to Baltimore City. And their big focus is actually reaching out to people who are currently not being reached. So, you know, a lot of this is in third world countries, just unreached people groups. When my wife and I took this class, we were thinking about what it means to live in the city. And so one of the things that I want to stress to each of us this morning is that if you are interested in working in an urban setting, you are, in a sense, stepping into a foreign culture. And here's why. We as Mennonites, we have our culture, we have our way of doing things, we have our way of connecting with each other, we have things that are important to us. We usually have larger families, we often like to do gardens. There's a number of things that we believe are important. Then there is, I'm going to take this the biggest picture, then there's mainstream American culture. Whatever that is. I mean, that's a broad picture, and you know, there's broad brush strokes. But when people look in on the United States, they have an idea of who Americans are. So we as Mennonites don't necessarily fit the picture of mainstream America. So even if we're trying to do ministry to our neighbors in suburbia, I'm not sure that we really have the tools to do that either. I'm not sure that we really thought about who the mainstream people are. And part of the reason, and going back to the some of those ideas, are we aware of what's happening in popular culture? Who are the most popular athletes or the best athletes? Who are the people, the characters in movies, that kind of thing? Those are things that we don't tend to be as aware of. Actually, maybe some people in the younger generation do. I don't know. What I do know of what happens in mainstream culture is actually what I learned from my neighbors for the most part. And since my wife and I run a daycare, we get to hear a lot about mainstream culture and some of those popular ideas. Another thing that's really big for people in mainstream society is education. So education is a way for us to move forward in life. It's a path to success. And that's pretty much across the board in America. Again, many of our churches are strong proponents of education, but it's for a different reason. It's not the same kind of emphasis as the mainstream American culture. So again, I'm trying to paint a picture as to how we are somewhat removed from mainstream culture. And then add to that the urban culture. Again, somewhat different. They're still within the mainstream culture, but it's still something a little bit different. And there are differences from the way that we do things. So a couple places that I want us to go. I'm going to be telling a number of stories this morning about my experience and what I've learned in the process of becoming an urban person. So yes, as Keyshawn said, I grew up Amish and then became part of a Mennonite church, so spent many of my late teenage years there. I'm still a Mennonite, but then transitioned to living in the city. And each of those is definitely a different cultural group of people. So I find my wife and I actually love to talk about culture, love to look at. Even the piece that I'm not going to have time to talk about is suburban versus urban. So there's a whole host of things that make us different in those ways. But I just don't have time to talk about it. When you leave today, actually, let me just say it. Part of the reason that I will be telling stories is they have informed my cultural journey, and my goal is not to say that, you know, the way things have happened for me is the way they should happen for you. It's hopefully to make this topic more practical. Ultimately, our goal of understanding people and figuring out what it means to adapt to their way of life, because I am going to suggest that we should be adapting some of what we believe and some of what we do. But ultimately, our goal of understanding and adapting to them should be to bring them into the kingdom. Now, I will say that my focus today is going to be primarily on getting to the point of understanding people. A good follow-up topic would be, how do we then bring them into the kingdom? But my focus today is, how do we get to the point where we understand our neighbors? So it's on cultural understanding. And when you leave today, I hope that you have two things. I hope you have a good sense as to how we can understand the culture. And even if we wanted to then take a look at what this means for mainstream culture, or what it means in Haiti, or what it means in Mexico, or what it means in Papua New Guinea, some of these same principles will apply. But when you leave today, I hope you have a good sense of how we can begin to understand culture. And secondly, I'm hoping that you can leave with some ideas about how we can adapt who we are, what we believe, to, in a sense, fit those around us. And that might not strike you, but we'll get to that. So hopefully you'll understand that there is some appropriate adapting, in my opinion. People in the city, so one story to begin, people in the city have a strong desire for a relationship. When we first were in the process of moving to the city, buying our house, it was about the third time we visited on our street, and our next-door neighbors, we met them for the first time of the day we were there to settle for our house. And we met them out in the front sidewalk. They introduced themselves, and they said, so you're Mennonites, you're moving to the city. They knew the kind of job that they knew that I was going to be working for the city school system. They knew how many children we have. And I'm like, wait, how did you guys know that? We didn't actually ask them that. We had talked to two of the neighbors at other times when we had visited that street when we were looking at the house. So it was very clear to us that the neighbors talked to each other. And that's part of what we really wanted to be in a place where people knew each other, where people got where they care about relationship. And in general, urban areas tend to be a place where that happens. One of the really, really fascinating things, these people are not practicing Christians, but one of their questions for us was, so there's no Mennonite church here. What are you guys going to do? So somehow they knew the importance that we as Mennonites place on community. And it was a question they had, which was really, really fascinating. So people want to connect with other people. Understanding the culture, some important steps. Actually, I should go back to this to give credit for this. I did mention Ralph Winter as the inspiration for this idea. He didn't draw this exact diagram, but he was a missionary among the Mayan Indians. And so his goal was trying to figure out how do we understand culture and how do we actually bridge the cultural boundaries that exist, those layers of culture, how do we get across them? So again, just making sure I give credit to him for that. And again, going back to the idea, if we actually want to, there's other layers that could be drawn here, but it is important for us to remember that we are a different culture when we go into an urban setting. And to it does us well to actually think about what that means. Ethnocentrism. So, and one of the things on the line, what I would like for you to put is, may God open our eyes. So, and that's not the definition of ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism is the idea that the world revolves around me, that my ideas are the only ideas. And realistically, this is how we see the world. We have this worldview. When we look at other people, we're like, why do they do that? How weird is that? And what is that? It's me interpreting their actions through my lens, through my way of seeing things. And that's just how we as people work. That's who we are. It's part of how God made us. So we tend to see the world through how we understand the world. Other people don't see it the same way. And when I talk about class differences in a bit, hopefully you'll see that more clearly. But ethnocentrism, the idea that the world, that my view is the only view. My goal for us, one of the central steps is us to ask God to open our eyes and to be willing to see something different. Because that's the only way that we can get to a place where we can truly make these people our own people. So asking God to open our eyes and being willing to immerse ourselves in that culture. I'm going to read, this actually comes from one of the writings in the Perspectives book, Philip Elkins, who was a missionary to Zambia, Africa. I think it is essential that we participate in a real way in the lifestyle and the struggles of the people we are sent to. When we do not ground our proclamation on our understanding of a people's hurts and felt needs, and we allow our own cultural understanding of the Christian message to blind us to what God once said in a radically different setting and culture, we invite failure. So we have to begin with a cultural understanding of the people before we try to change who they are. So one of the things that I'm suggesting that we do is we simply immerse ourselves in their culture and sit back. Well, and part of the difficulty is, and actually my wife and I were very guilty of this, when we went to the city, we're like, we have some things together. We as Mennonites have a lot to offer these people. And we do. However, be very careful with that attitude, because it can very quickly become a situation of us and them. We have the ideas, they're different, and man, they really just need it to get it together. That may be true, but we are never going to get to the level where we will deeply interact with them and connect with their hearts if that's the attitude that we have. And actually, the main topic this morning, I thought was fascinating. He talked about the fact that we need to be able to have nationals as our friends. And I'm saying the same thing here in urban sense. We need to have these people as our own friends if we really want to make a deep impact on them. So being willing to immerse ourselves. Actually, so I started by saying that my wife and I were rather arrogant in thinking that we had the answers. You know, we don't have, but we as Mennonites are good at building family, and we have strong families. So we thought, well, definitely that's something we can take to our neighbors. What we found when we moved into a middle-class neighborhood is that we didn't find broken families on our street. Since we've lived there, there's only been actually one family that's been there where their husband and wife divorced. Otherwise, the people who have children, the mom and dad are together, and they have a normal family. And that's the case in with a lot of the parents that we work with that send children to our school. These are intact families. So one of the things that we quickly learned is that, oh, whoops, maybe we don't have that to teach them. So we have different values and so on than they do. But let's be careful about going in there knowing that we have all the ideas and being willing to learn from these people. And being willing to engage very deeply with the people. And the picture that I like us to think about is being willing to spend time doing the same things that our neighbors do. So... and ask them questions. Ask them, you know, where do you go to the doctor? Where do you go to the grocery store? Those are questions that we asked our neighbors when we moved there. When we moved to Baltimore, we were the only family in our ministry that was there. There was another family that moved there several years later, but we were there by ourselves. So we had to reach out to our neighbors for just relational support and to figure out, where do you find things? Where do you go to the store, to the dentist? Where do you take your children to the dentist? Those are questions we had to ask. And that's something that is a good way to put you on the same playing field as your neighbors, where you, in a sense, need them. And you have that reciprocal relationship that happens. Because oftentimes, we now have a Mennonite community that's much larger, and so our new staff members that come down to be part of our work, they can very easily just connect with each other. And that's okay. That's okay. Again, because as my neighbors ask, so where's the Mennonite church? Well, we now have a Mennonite church. But one of the problems is that I don't connect as much with my neighbors as we did the first couple years we were there before the church was there. So, but there are, you can still do that, again, if you make it a focus to actually reach out and engage with their neighbors. And this simply takes time. One of the things when we actually established a mission there in Baltimore, our goal was to actually just simply take the time to learn to know the people before we actually start any programs. And so sometimes I think we can go in and, you know, want to start programs, and that's a good thing, you know, to use those to build the kingdom. But our goal was to simply take the time to get to know the people and figure out what are their needs, what are the needs they have, what are the ways that we can actually help them. So I'm going to make kind of a pretty drastic shift here. And when my family moved from we've been in Baltimore for about 10 years, we moved from Ephrata, Pennsylvania. We had lived there for about 5 years before we moved there. We moved there and we had two children, and we were gearing up for a fair amount of culture shock. We anticipated the fact that it would be fairly difficult for us to move there, changes and so on. What we found was actually quite surprising. Our neighbors were very welcoming of us. Within several weeks of being there, we knew probably a third of the people on our block. When we lived in Ephrata, we knew the 1, 2, 3, 4 people like right around us. That was it. That was it. Which is actually one of the phenomenons of suburbia versus urban. So we expected culture shock. We received very little of it. And part of that was the fact that we moved into a middle-class neighborhood, which... we as Mennonite people, even if we aren't rich, even if we don't economically fit in the middle class, we think like middle class people. And there's, again, I'm going to come back to some of those realities. Now, I know that's a lot of missions who work in the urban setting work with people who are not in the middle class, who are in the lower class. So we didn't meet culture shock in the neighborhood where we lived in, but when I started working in the public school system, that's where... I ran a serious culture shock. I almost titled this "Ghetto Issues," but that term's not really politically correct. So I decided to keep it as urban issues. But these are urban poor issues, and this was an extremely different world. And when these kids would tell me stories and talk to me about what's happening in their lives, and just observing them, it was hard to even imagine what their life was like, because it was so astronomically different from the life that I grew up with. So that's a little bit of what I'm going to tell you about. First story about gang affiliation. Now, a lot of times when kids become part of gangs, it's because they need a place to fit. They need a place to fit, and it's also sometimes they do it for survival. Many of the choices that people in the lower class culture make, or in the poverty culture make, many of the choices they make are for survival. And so that's part of why they join gangs. So one day, while I was having, I think it was maybe during my lunch period, there was two students tussling out in the hall. So I looked out. What are they doing? And here it was Lamar. And so a boy who was tussling with a girl, wrestling with a girl in the hallway. I said, Lamar, please, what's up with this? Now, this is I've only been there for 2 months at this point. So I'm still pretty scared. Nobody even – the students had – they didn't have any need to listen to me. They didn't anyway. So he just ignored me, which is kind of what I expected. One of the things that he messed up on, his hat had fallen off and it was laying on the side of the hallway. It's like, ah, got him. So I picked up his hat, went walking back to my classroom, and when I got to my classroom, he realized that I had my hat. He just kind of left to go. So I stuck on my filing cabinet and locked it because I had to keep my filing cabinet locked. Another story for another day. But anyway, so he said, I want my hat. I said, you'll get it, Lamar. Come see me after school and we'll have a conversation. Simple enough. All right, so after school, I get a knock on my door. Oh, that must be Lamar. Actually, this is about 20 minutes after school, so I was expecting before that, but no. And it was a school police officer. Okay. He said, you need to give Lamar back his hat. I said, sure. Once I actually have a conversation with him and he understands this kind of behavior is not okay. He said, no, you don't understand. You need to give him his hat back. And he said, I'll explain later. So the story later was that so Lamar was a gang member, and if he walked out of the building without his hat on, without his mark, without his gang sign, he was actually very likely going to be beat up, or worse. So again, once they make that choice to be part of the gang, then they have to continue to affiliate with it, and they're kind of stuck there. And so I kind of lost out as a teacher that day, but I didn't have a choice, because there were bigger issues at stake than him tussling in the hallway with a female student. That's part of the reality that they have. Drug usage. A lot of times the kids that you may work with or the adults that you may work with, the reason that they turn to drugs is their lives are in such shambles. There is just no place they have to go for hope. And so we have the message of the gospel that can give them hope. But part of the reason they turn to drugs is it's a way to escape the reality and to just get out of the situation that I'm in. Broken homes. the story I'll tell here is also slightly embarrassing, but I had this student Juan. He was in a group home. So this was a ninth grade student. He was probably 15. he just knew how to push my buttons. I think he knew probably knew how to push all the teachers' buttons. Again, fairly new. I didn't have a clue what to do. He came in one day and he grabbed the toilet paper. Why did I have toilet paper in the classroom? Not because we had a bathroom in the room, but because we didn't have tissues. Low budgets in the city of school system. So I had, instead of tissues, we had toilet paper sitting there. So he takes the roll of toilet paper and we had fluorescent lights that hung down from the ceiling. So he takes the toilet paper, tosses it up over it, and you know, proceeds to wrap the fluorescent lights. Today it's actually fairly easy to laugh about it. But he came in there at the same time everybody, all the other students are coming in. They're like, what in the world's he going to do now? At any rate, I had a hard time figuring it. I tried in many ways to connect with Juan and actually tried very hard to become his friend and find something that he cared about. In talking to other teachers, they're like, he doesn't seem to, he wasn't the, most times with inner city kids, they're interested in sports. He didn't even seem to be interested in sports. He had gotten, nobody cared about him. Nobody really cared about him, really loved him. He was there for about another month before, I'm not sure what happened with him, but at the point when I had him in my classroom, he was in about the fourth group home in about 2 years. And before that, he'd been through a variety of foster homes. So he'd been in a lot of different places and had, nobody loved him. That's the kind of realities that these people bring with them. So again, back to how do we understand culture? Some of these people bring with them a boatload of issues. And in order to really experience them, now I didn't live in their neighborhood, but if that's the group of people that you want to impact, then you really need to step into their neighborhood and actually deal with these issues yourself, wrestle with them yourself, which is not easy. The ability to manipulate. There's a couple stories I could tell here. So the one I'll tell is about two female students. They were passing notes. Their desks were like right here and right here. And they were passing notes right in front of me. And so I just grabbed the paper at one point when it was sitting on the top of their desk. It was easy for me to do. And they immediately got extremely upset. I calmly folded it up and put it in my pocket. And I threatened to read it to the rest of the class since, you know, they weren't supposed to be passing notes during class. Although most of the times they texted and everything else too. But anyway, so I kept that and realized that it upset them pretty deeply. After class, or later on that day, I'm not sure when, they came back to me and said, we really like that paperback. You were passing notes during class. No, I mean, I did. And they wanted to make sure that I'm not going to read it, not going to share it with anybody. And the conversation went on about a minute, and the one girl just started crying. And, like, really crying. And so, like, wow, this must be something really serious. So eventually I relented, even though I really didn't want to. I wasn't going to actually read the note, but the more the bigger fuss they made about it, the more I was interested in reading it. but I didn't. I ended up giving it back to them, partly because I wanted to retain my relationship with them. But when they got the note back, the tears stopped like that. So they completely turned on those tears, turned on the crying, because they knew how to do it. Again, I said earlier, it's about survival for these kids. And so some of what they do is about survival. And so they do some unique things. But again, they're trying to survive in the world that they live in. There's a host of other issues I could talk about, but there's other things that I would like to talk about. Class differences. So some of this is not filled out in your handout. If you do work with people in poverty, I highly, highly, highly recommend this book. It's actually listed on the end of your handout. Ruby Payne. This is her fourth edition. I think she has a fifth edition out. This is much more readable than her first edition. It was very dry and boring and just charts, and I had a hard time not falling asleep with it. This is actually much better. But it is a fascinating look at how she does a very good job of actually thinking about how do these people work. What is their worldview? What is the lens at which they look at the world? So I picked just a few things out of one of her lists. There's actually about 15 things. And she compares lower class, middle class, and upper class. I'm just not going there because, again, we don't have time for that. For the lower class people, their possessions are people. This is what they care the most about. And so part of the reason, if you are teaching a class and they're being disruptive in your class, one of the things that they value is humor. One of the ways that they keep their friends, one of the ways that they get people connected to them is through entertaining them. So if they're being a pain in your class, it might not be because of you, but it might be because they're trying to make brownie points with their friends or just simply be more connected with them. For middle class people, it's things. Money is to be spent, used. For the middle class, it's to be managed. She tells the story of one woman who she went to church and talked about the fact that she got a bonus of $400 over Christmas. After church, three people came and talked to her and asked her for the money. And she gave it to them. She needed it. But their mindset is that we're never going to get ahead anyway. If I have money, I'll either spend it or share it. So in some ways, they actually have a lot of generosity because they do help each other out. And actually, when I work with these kids, I saw that. This happened all the time. They always came to school hungry, but they wouldn't bring lunch alone. Out of five girls that often sat in my room to eat lunch, usually only one or two of them had food alone. And they would share what little bit they had every time. Anyway, they have some things to teach us about generosity. Food, key question. Did you have enough? The quantity is important. For us, did you like it? The quality is important. Now, if you go to the higher class people, the question is, did it look nice? So it's about the presentation, what it looks like, what it's put out on the table or on the food bar, whatever it might be. Time, the present is most important. This is by far the biggest thing that I learned when I work with these kids in the city school system, that time, the present is the most important. I eventually concluded that even if they knew they were, quote, going to have to serve detention after school, which there was actually really no way I could make them serve detention after school, they didn't really care. That was not going to change their behavior right now. They didn't think long term. And we all say, well, you know, if they just, or a lot of Mennonites say, if they just figured out a way to get ahead, it's not part of their worldview. They think in a fundamentally different way. And again, she does an excellent job of actually pointing that out and talking about how they think in an extremely different way. And actually, just reading this again in preparation for this topic, I was actually thinking of a student who used to come to our school, and I was telling our teachers, you know, some of the things, if we were to look at some of what she would help us in actually learning how to reach out to this student and actually make a greater impact on her. I'm going to read, I wish I would have the, what page do I want here? Page 33. This is a story of Cinderella. If I had the time, I would be able to do this story about, you know, Noah and the flood or something. But again, if you work with people from poverty, this may connect with you. This actually resonated very deeply with me. So we know the story of Cinderella, you know, and it happens in a fairly. If I were to tell you the story from what I remember Cinderella, it would be in a fairly linear, logical pattern. Now, when you're talking about people from the lower class, they tell a story differently. And it's more of an interchange. It's not necessarily linear. Well, you know, Cinderella married the prince in spite of that old nasty stepmother. Pointy eyes, the old thing, old hag. Good thing she had a fairy godmother or she would have never made it to the ball. Lucky thing. God blessed her ragged tail. Wish I had me a fairy godmother. And to think, she nearly messed it up big time by staying until the clock was striking 12 after all the fairy godmother had done for her. She should have known better. Eyes too full of the prince they were. They didn't call him the prince for no reason. When she got to the ball, her stepsisters and stepmother didn't even recognize her. She was so beautiful without those rags. Served them right. No good jealous hags. Again, there's this back and forth. So it's a two-way conversation. And again, when I taught in the public school system, that's the kind of conversation. There was always things happening in the classroom, in the room besides what I was doing. Actually, the one of the story that I was going to talk about there is one school district. They actually decided. Ruby Payne talks about the teachers decided to go together and buy the a family a refrigerator because they didn't have one. And so, several weeks later, the family was gone for about a week. They came back to school. The teachers asked them what happened, and they said, "We went camping." "Oh, where'd you get the money?" "We sold the refrigerator." Again, it's a very different value system. If you want to impact the people, you have to actually take the time and be willing to be deeply vested in their culture. Now, adapt to the local culture. The question is this what we do? Should we actually do this? So once we actually understand who the people are, do we try to become like them? And the question is, how do we actually become culturally relevant? The biggest answer to shall we adapt to the local culture is what I have at the bottom. And if you think of the story of Ruth, she told Naomi, "Thy people shall be my people." That's the bottom line. That's my bottom line answer as to whether we should adapt to the culture and even the peace of understanding. We need to make these people our people. Wherever it is that you live, you need to be willing to make these people your people, to be willing to live life on their level. And if you're going to reach out to the people in poverty, it means actually living a different kind of life. I concluded with working with those kids. Part of the reason we didn't move into a poverty situation was because we weren't sure that our family could actually handle it. Because I think it's a very intense sort of environment. We weren't sure we could handle it, which is why we chose to live in the middle class area. But I think that is part of what God calls us to do, to make these people our own people. I'm going to look at a couple passages of Scripture. We are told, love not the world, neither the things in the world, right? We are also told, be not conformed to this world. So these are things that we are told in Scripture. And I don't have a lot of time to develop this, but just that is what Scripture tells us. Don't become part of this world that we live in. So even if whatever part of the city you live in, what does it mean to not become part of the world? What I'd like to suggest basically is if we think about the two kingdoms, we're either part of God's kingdom or that we're part of this world's kingdom. So which one? Obviously, God calls us to be part of his kingdom, but then how do we actually engage with the people around us? Where does the rubber actually meet the road? So we need to make the people our people, but we also need to clearly still follow God's leading. And ultimately, in the process of becoming, making these people our people, showing them how Jesus would live in their situation. So, but it's actually, again, not bringing our ideas with us, our ideas from suburbia or wherever it might be, but being willing to let those ideas behind, become part of their culture, and show them what it means to be a Christian, how it means to, what it means to follow Jesus in that situation. Jesus, you shall be witnesses unto me in Jerusalem and in all Judea and in Samaria unto the uttermost parts of the earth. He wanted to take the disciples to take the gospel to all parts of the earth, but he was also interested in them taking the gospel to Samaria. And Scripture tells us a bit about Samaria. It wasn't really a cool place to go. It wasn't the same kind of culture. It was when Jesus saw the Samaritan woman at the well, sat there and talked with her, his disciples came up and almost scandalized about the fact that he's having this conversation. This is not – even she said, why are you having this – why are you asking me? Why are you having – he asked her to get some water for him. Why are you asking me? We don't associate with each other. But Jesus calls his disciples to go to Samaria, to go to places where it's not necessarily comfortable. When Paul went to the Greeks, there were significant cultural differences as well. They didn't even really believe in the same God. They had a different system, a religious system. And yet Paul goes to them. And Paul, the other example that I'm going to get from Paul, he and this is from 1 Corinthians 9, verses 9 through 19 through 23. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone. Why? To win as many as possible. To the Jews, I become like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I become like one under the law. Though I myself am not under the law, because I want to win those under the law. Skipping ahead to verse 23. To the weak, I become weak. To win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means, whatever means possible, I may win some. Or I may help some get into to the kingdom. So Paul was willing to adjust what he was doing to become like the people around him so that he could help them. So that still leaves us with a bit of a question. How do we actually love these people? But again, I go back to the picture of being willing to make these people our people. I'm going to tell just, I have time to tell, I'm going to tell this story yet. Unattended children. Our neighbor right next door, soon after we moved there, one of our children was out playing out front because my wife had gone in to get the keys for the vehicle or something. My neighbor, a day or so later, confronted my wife and said, you know, it's not really okay to leave children unattended in the city. And she was the kind of parent that was fairly concerned if her children were in the – even if our children were in the backyard by themselves, she didn't really like that, thought it was not a good thing. Philosophically, we thought it was okay for them to be there because we're okay with them actually being – getting into some potential danger. She was also the kind of parent who didn't want her children to get too high on the climbing equipment because they might fall off. So she was right there protecting them. And so part of what we explained to her is that, you know, we actually are willing to have our kids take some risks so that they learn how to be responsible for themselves. We actually, so after that interchange, we actually had about a year where we didn't interact with this, with the neighbor at all. And we concluded that it was the fact that they were not okay with our position on child raising. So we did actually work harder at making sure that our children, when they were in the public and on the front street, were very observed and tried to be more present there. But we still let them take risks. What was really, really fascinating, last week, I think it was either Monday or Tuesday, I was unloading my van, so carrying stuff from my backyard, back and forth to my van, and their oldest son, who's about 9, he comes out, and he's talking to me as we're carrying back stuff back and forth. I'm like, wait, where's Mom? Mom's not there. So he's out there. We're having a conversation. He's telling about how he flew his helicopter to Canada recently. It was a secret mission, though. He couldn't tell me what it was about. And about 3 minutes later, his younger brother comes out. And so they're both there. We're kind of chatting with each other. And about 2 minutes later, Mom comes out. Anyway, I tell that story because a couple years ago, that wouldn't have happened. So some of their patterns of child raising have changed. And they would like for us, they periodically joke that they're just going to send their kids over to us. What's two more kids? We have 5 kids already. What's two more? So can we learn from our neighbors? Again, I call us to thinking about our attitude, not going into the situation with all the answers. the one story I said, the environmentalist. So what I have found in the city has actually been very, very refreshing. So yes, the people in the city tend to be fairly environmentalist. That's the direction they, because in the city they're more liberal. I have become more liberal since I've lived in the city because I've become a bit more like the people around me because I love them. But these are not people who are out there preaching about this and hitting people over the head because they're not being environmentalists. They are simply saying that here's a different way of life. They have a different philosophy. But they actually have very good views in doing it. They're willing to spend quite a bit more money in order to protect our world. But they're not extremists. So the part that was actually refreshing in getting to know these people is that they're not extremists in their environmentalism. So, but it was being willing to actually hear them and hear what they believe. So, bridging the cultural gap. This is basically in conclusion. Understand the worldview of your chosen people, and that takes time. And I'm suggesting several years, because even if you look at, there's many, many, many case studies that are given in the perspectives course, and they talk about taking at least 2 years to, you know, get to know these people, know their culture, how they think, how they work, study them, ask questions, learn about them as much as you can, and then I have to tell another story. So relying on your neighbors. One of the things, these people shall be my people. My wife was pregnant. I think it was with our fourth child. we had to go to the hospital like 1:30 in the morning. So we drove the van down two blocks away from our house. The tire went flat. There was no way we were going to go another 3 miles to the hospital. So I knew my neighbors up fairly late. So 1:30 in the morning, Jamie, can I borrow your car? Yeah, sure. Hold on. Let me get the keys. And he gave me his car keys. You know, no questions asked. And this is after we'd been there maybe 2 years. How willing are we to actually knock on our neighbor's door and ask them for something? That's part of where you actually go a long way in developing your relationship. Show them Jesus in the midst of their lifestyle. Any questions you have, we have a couple minutes yet, or even perspectives you have about how do you actually come to understand the culture, or how do you adapt to it?
You didn't answer your one question. How do we love the people without condemning what they do?
I did not answer that question, which is a big question.
I agree.
Yeah, and so what I would say, first of all, is rather than thinking about what they're doing wrong, actually really become closely connected with them. But the other part of it is making sure that our lives are following Christ. So our neighbors know that we don't drink. So we sometimes will go to a restaurant with them, or they'll have us over for a meal. They know that we don't drink. So there's different things that they know that we won't do. But there are some ways in which we've changed. So there are many things about our culture that we can actually do differently and still follow Christ. So that's still a general answer to your question. But it's not an easy answer. But again, my biggest thing that I want to see people do is learn to understand the people. Other questions?
I was struck by your presentation. Thank you very, very much. I was thinking about the juxtaposition that you had of lower class and middle class and so forth, and think about some of the stuff you articulated, that it's people rather than possessions, that people are willing to give away resources they need themselves.
Right.
That don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself.
Right, right.
It strikes me that these poor folks are like Jesus.
Right.
Maybe we should ask who should be learning from who.
Right. Right. And that's and you're hitting at part of what we can learn from our neighbors. We can learn from these people. Often I think we come in thinking we have the answers, but they have a lot to teach us, even if they're living in sin. Thank you for being here.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.